From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. God is dead, the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche once proclaimed. And for much of the last century, countries around the world, from France to Turkey to China, tried to banish religion from public life. Well, guess what? God is back. Today, we'll examine this religious revival. We'll also talk with Robert Wright about his controversial book, The Evolution of God.
At its birth, monotheism was fundamentally about retribution. Israel was a small nation in a bad neighborhood that had gotten kicked around. And you get the sense that monotheism is about punishing the various nations that have persecuted Israel.
Also, the remarkable tale of a group of Christian and Muslim women who came together through prayer and helped bring down Liberia's corrupt strongman, Charles Taylor.
Because they had people from both sides, there was really not much Taylor could do. What was he going to do? Kill a bunch of women, and they all dressed like in white to represent that they were like taken from the Bible, where Esther dresses in sackcloth and ashes and saying that, you know, we want peace, we want peace.
But first, the story of an NPR reporter who went looking for the science of spirituality. Barbara Bradley Haggerty is National Public Radio's religion reporter. She's also a practicing Christian, though over the years she found herself wondering if her faith could really stand up to the latest scientific discoveries about the brain. So she went on a personal odyssey of sorts, interviewing mystics, skeptics, and a wide range of scientists, and wrote a book about what she found called Fingerprints of God. Haggerty told Steve Paulson that a very strange experience launched her on this quest.
Back in 1995, I was doing a story for the LA Times Sunday magazine, and it was why some churches grow and other churches don't grow. And I was talking to people about their spiritual journey, and one woman I was talking to was named Kathy Young. It was nighttime, it was after the Saturday night service, and we're sitting outside under a street lamp, and she was talking to me about her faith, and she mentioned that the melanoma that she had actually returned, but that she didn't see this return of the melanoma as an attempt by God to kill her, but to give her a transcendent purpose. And I got to tell you that it was a really powerful statement. And as she continued to talk about her spiritual journey, something really, really strange happened, Steve. It was as if someone stepped inside the circle of light that we were sitting in and began to breathe on us. You know, the air grew moist and warm, as if there was someone breathing. And it wasn't just me that noticed this. She was mid-sentence, and she just stopped talking. And we both sat there for about 30 seconds, 60 seconds maybe, feeling this atmosphere change. And then it receded and went away, and I was incredibly spooked. So I shut down the interview. I said, thanks a lot. Talk to you later. And drove back to L.A. But the recurring question I had, the one that haunted me, was I crazy? Was that just brain chemistry? Or was it possible that somehow we had kind of tapped into a spiritual reality, or put in kind of simpler terms, is there a God who can breathe on you, who occasionally intervenes and pierces through this veil of reality that we believe in? And so, you know, it was really that story, that mystical experience, that launched me on this journey and made me ask all the big questions.
Now, how did you approach this subject? Because I know, as you write about in your book, you come from a background of religious faith. Mm-hmm. Did that help shape your inquiry into these questions, or did you come at it really open to finding just about anything?
Well, you know, you want to think, as a journalist, you want to think, of course, that you're completely unbiased. But, of course, our worldviews and our experiences shape us, right? And because I did come from a Christian Science background where we seem to see, at least, the power of prayer on our bodies, healings and things like that, because of that, you know, I was open to spiritual experience. I was kind of hoping that God isn't a ruse. Now, I was open to the idea that maybe it would turn out that science would show it's all brain chemistry. Every spiritual experience we have is brain chemistry. And that, you know, some people are just genetically wired toward transcendent experiences, just as they're more wired toward, say, being artists or something like that. That this was just a physical phenomenon. I was open to that. I was afraid that I might find that. But what I eventually found is that science is kind of actually agnostic on the issue. That science can't say whether there is a God or isn't a God. Both conclusions are plausible.
Now, you talked to a lot of people who reported having mystical experiences, and Some of those compelling stories you write about are what we would commonly call near-death experiences, and you've given us some snippets of interviews that you recorded, and I want to play one of these with a man named Edward Salisbury, who was in a bad car wreck many years ago.
As I was driving, I hit the curb, and it was sort of a sudden shock, and the next thing I know is a big bang, like you get hit from a swinging door from behind, totally surprised. The next thing I felt was seeing that tree and merging, actually literally becoming one with that tree. I felt myself flow in as if going through the arteries of the tree up to the top leaf and popping out. And as I looked around, it was like I was looking off a balcony and I said, that car looks like mine. But it was, you know, it's crashed, it's burning. People running out of the house. I looked a little closer and there's this body slumped over the steering wheel. And I had to think and I said, that's my body. If that's my body, then, you know, who am I?
Okay. What do you make of that story?
Well, first, I should say that I interviewed a whole lot of people who had had near-death experiences, and I heard this kind of thing over and over and over again. What I have to say about near-death experiences is I don't know if they're real or not. And the reason I say that is because I think near-death experiences are explainable through material means. I mean, I think you can make a plausible argument that this is what a brain does when it's oxygen deprived or when it's, you know, has sudden trauma, when it's shutting down, that it steals memories from the hippocampus and it hears voices and creates delusions or illusions. Mm-hmm. So it's an open question.
Let's hear another bit of an interview that you did with someone else who had a near-death experience. Pam Reynolds is her name. She had brain surgery for an aneurysm and was in a deep coma, according to her doctor. But she says that during the surgery, she was aware of what was going on. In fact, she heard sounds, even music.
And as the sound continued, I don't know how to explain this other than go ahead and say it, I popped out of the top of my head. And I could feel like a suction cup at the top of my head popping. And then I was looking down at the body, and I knew it was my body. And again, an odd thing, I didn't care. It was wonderful. Colors were brighter, sounds were more intense. It was as if every sense that I'd ever known were perfect.
And didn't you talk to her doctors after this had happened and who said that, I mean, basically corroborated her account, and they said there's no way she should have been able to hear or be aware of any of this because she was in a coma.
Absolutely. They did say that. Her neurosurgeon said he had no scientific explanation for this, and it actually changed his view of reality. It had to make him rethink his kind of more material view of reality. You know, Steve, what is fascinating about the Pam Reynolds case to me is not the near-death experience, but the clip you just played, which is the out-of-body experience, because she raises, I think, a really fascinating question, and that is, can consciousness or the mind operate when the brain seems to be not functioning well? For example, if we had listened a little bit further, what we would have heard her say is that her eyes were taped shut. Her ears had clickers in them that were sounding as loud as a jet plane taking off 90 to 100 decibels, and that was so they could measure the brainstem activity so that they could actually lower body temperature and drain the blood out of her head, which you don't want to do when you have brainstem activity. She was also in this deep coma. And yet she saw and heard things that would be very difficult to see or hear. She saw what the operating room looked like. She saw what the Midas Rex bone saw looked like. She said it looked like an electric toothbrush. She could describe the drill bits. She heard conversations. She heard one surgeon say, gosh, her left femoral vein is too small, and another say, well, then try her right vein. And she saw the resuscitation. So she seemed to see things and accurately report things that really she had no business seeing or hearing, because she supposedly could not perceive anything, her eyes being taped shut and her ears, you know, being clogged and being in a coma. Now, this raises the question, could her consciousness be operating? What one doctor told me is, one who didn't believe that this was any particularly special story. He said, you know, it could have been that the earplugs were loose and she could have heard conversations. She was awakened. She had anesthesia awareness. She was awakened and she could hear things, and therefore she could create a picture in her mind of all that was going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, I have queued up a bit of a tape from one of these skeptics, an Australian anesthesiologist, Gerald Worley.
That's right.
Who thinks these kinds of stories are rubbish. I mean, delightful rubbish, but still, I mean, they don't really suggest out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences or anything like that.
In my opinion, their consciousness has absolutely not left their brain. What they are experiencing is a wonderful illusion generated by the functioning of their body. Heart massage is always applied during a cardiac arrest. And what does heart massage do? It's a method of causing a pumping action of the heart so that blood is circulated around the body. And while they're conscious, they can hear and they can see. One of my colleagues in a hospital nearby does experiments with oxygen starvation. And he says, these people, they feel fantastic.
So he's saying it's just a physiological reaction to radical changes that are going on inside the body and also the brain. That's what explains these remarkable experiences.
Absolutely. And you know what? That could explain all of these experiences. It could explain every out-of-body experience. The interesting thing, the reason I focused on Pam Reynolds is because, A, her account is corroborated. Now, of course, Gerald Worley could be completely right. You know, we don't know. We really don't know. I just think that her case is one of the more interesting ones to raise the question about the nature of consciousness.
And this is really one of the underlying questions in this whole debate. I mean, this gets at the question of whether the mind is just the brain. I mean, the physical mechanics of the brain, or whether there's some dimension of the mind that goes beyond the brain. And a lot rides on how you answer that question.
That's right. And, you know, this is not a question that's at the margins. This is a really, really robust debate right now in neuroscience. I mean, this isn't just people who are studying near-death experiences who have this question. Neurologists everywhere are wondering if consciousness is an emergent property of the brain or if it's just in the brain. And so a case like Pam Reynolds might contribute to the debate, but it certainly doesn't define the debate. This is a raging debate right now. And I don't know, you know, I don't know when they're going to answer the question, but big minds are thinking about this stuff.
So you've interviewed a lot of these people, scientists as well as people who report these experiences. Have you come to any conclusions yourself?
What I ended up concluding in terms of the way I think about God or spiritual reality or whatever you want to call it is that there's a plausible case to be made that there is such a thing as spiritual reality. And you know what? I'm not kind of alone in this. A lot of people, but a lot of really smart people, believed the same thing. I mean, Albert Einstein talked about God as an infinite intelligence. You know,
but he also didn't believe that God actually intervened in the physical world.
Absolutely. A God that I could defend, say, at a cocktail party or with a scientist friend would not be a personal God that intervenes, that breaks the laws of nature. I think not a lot of people who are scientists would be convinced of that God. However, a God that I think might be more plausible, one that scientists could believe in, is this notion of an infinite intelligence that created the universe, that geared it toward life. Freeman Dyson talks about it's as if the universe knew we were coming, that the universe seems to be so finely tuned toward life that a lot of people don't think it's random, and a God perhaps that crafted our genes and our brains to be able to perceive that kind of God. That's not an interventionist God. For me, I think it's plausible when you look at the extraordinary wirings of our brain and how common these spiritual experiences are to think that maybe it's not just mass delusion. You know, 51% of people have said they have had a transcendent experience that absolutely transformed their lives. There was a before and an after. They could circle it on a calendar. Maybe 51% of Americans are crazy. But maybe not. Maybe they're just human. And maybe this is part of the human condition that on occasion we are able to tap into, to connect with a reality that we might not be able to measure, but we can feel. And that leaves evidence of itself, both in our brains and our bodies, but also in the way we view the world.
That's NPR's religion reporter Barbara Bradley Haggerty talking with Steve Paulson. Her book is called Fingerprints of God. What do you think? Can science tell us much about spiritual experience? If you'd like to share your thoughts or experiences, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up, why religion is making a comeback around the world. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Adrian Wooldridge is the Washington bureau chief for The Economist magazine. He's also an atheist. And with John Micklethwaite, co-author of the book God is Back, How the Global Revival of Faith is Changing the World, Wooldridge says something very unexpected happened. Religion has not only survived, but thrived in the modern era, even though many people gave it up for dead.
What we're arguing in this book, essentially, is that there were two versions of the Enlightenment. There was the European view, particularly the French view of the Enlightenment, which argued that God, that is religion, and modernity were essentially incompatible, that the more modern the world became, the more it threw off the fetters of medievalism and feudalism and the rest of it, the more enlightened it would become, which meant the more agnostic or atheistic it would become. Then there was the American view, which was much more questioning than that, which said that countries could easily become much more modern, but at the same time retain a vigorous religious life, that there was no incompatibility between the two. Now, through most of the 20th century, it looked as though the European view, modernization equals the retreat of God, was the one that was winning. It was winning in countries such as Turkey. It was winning throughout the Islamic world, in the Middle East. It was winning, of course, in the communist world. Religion seemed to be on the retreat. Modernization seemed to equal secularization. There was one big exception to that, of course, which was the United States, where you had a vigorous religious life, plus, of course, in many ways, the world's most modern technology, the most advanced country in the world. But even in America, I think most intellectuals sort of thought of America as being the odd exception that eventually would catch up with Europe. Now, I think that what's happened over the last 25 years is a fundamental change, which leads me to think that, in fact, the world is going to go America's way rather than Europe's way.
Well, let's take some examples and explore them. The way you begin God is Back is with a tale about Shanghai, the Christian community there, what are called house churches. It sounds like a social club in some ways, the way you talk about it, but it is real Christianity and one that would be recognized just about anywhere.
What's going on in China is absolutely fascinating. You have in China, which of course not that long ago was an officially atheist country, you have somewhere between 80 million and 100 million Christians. It's a very Christian society. It's also a very Islamic society. There's a huge Islamic population there. But we went to a house church in Shanghai, and what we saw there was a group of people who were very professional. They were company executives, they were scientists, but they were all there in this rather luxurious apartment to worship God and to discuss the Holy Scripture. They spent several hours reading the Bible to each other, interpreting parts of the Bible, singing hymns, and they're part of this extraordinary thing called the house church movements, whereby people go to worship essentially in each other's homes.
What surprised me about the description was that some of the issues they discussed seemed more fundamentalist than you would expect from a group of intellectuals gathering that way, especially scientists. There was one of the members you talked about who was engaged in stem cell research, and yet the discussion ridiculed evolution. There seems to be a conflict, and it's that conflict between religiosity and modernism that is hard to explain, isn't it?
It's extremely hard to explain, and as you say, there's a very vivid example of this lady who spent all day studying stem cells but believed that they could not be accounted for by evolution. They needed to be divinely inspired because they were so beautiful. And yet the people there in that room didn't see this tension, which seems so obvious to us. They were happy to be fundamentalists, but also happy to be successful professionals and scientists. And if you ask them about the tension, they would say in their mind that Christianity in China was a symbol of China's modernization. a symbol of China's success. And they would say, well, atheism, that's all part of the old world. That's all part of, you know, the world of enforced communism, which brought poverty and degradation, and which has obviously failed. And so it seems strange to us, but it seemed absolutely, you know, not even a problem for them.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it? Because it suggests that the Christianity they are developing, while it looks like the one we're familiar with, isn't quite. I mean, this one, the way you describe it, seems to be a reaction against the suppression of religion during the communist rule, during Mao's rule, and yet you say they also still praise Mao.
It's very strange, but I think one of the things that you see there is Christianity, the notion of Christianity has become caught up with the notion of national greatness. They think that Christianity is one of the things that will make China once again a great country. They also see Mao as in some ways attempting at least to make China a great country. And so they think that they want to become Christian in order to become successful, entrepreneurial, commercially vigorous. And the country that they point to is, in fact, the United States. They say, look at the United States, this incredibly powerful, incredibly successful country, or up till now incredibly successful country. We'd like to be like them. And one of the things that have made them great is Christianity. So we want to embrace Christianity.
It also may be the source of some conflict, though, isn't it? I mean, Christianity is also experiencing a huge surge in Africa, but the kind of Christianity there has already developed some conflicts with the same sects in American churches. Are we going to see that same kind of conflict within the Christian world from country to country?
I think that the sort of conflict that we're likely to see is much more a conflict between Christianity and Islam. And what we see in Africa is a resurgent Christianity, particularly evangelical and Pentecostal Christianity, rubbing up against a resurgent Islam. And one of the most important places where this is happening is Nigeria, where you see Islam moving southwards, Christianity, a lot of it supported by American evangelicals, moving northwards. You see Islam and Christianity, both of whom are very aggressive religions, both of whom want to capture souls and bring souls to what they consider to be the truth, in conflict with each other. And I think this is a real potential for warfare, conflict, and disagreement.
Do you see evidence of the conflict between modernity and religiosity in the development of Islam?
I think a lot of Arab leaders essentially misunderstood the proper relationship between the church or the mosque and the state. What they essentially bought into was the European idea that in order to become modern, they needed to marginalize and essentially castrate religion. So you saw Ataturk, for example, pushing religion to one side, getting rid of the clerical hierarchy and introducing a form of secularism, which was, you know, a very French form of laicism, essentially moving religion entirely out of public life. You saw exactly the same with the Shah of Iran, who introduced a very secular regime and very deliberately marginalized the clergy. And they were looking to Europe, and particularly to France, as the model of how to do this. And I think this was a mistake. The model that they needed to look at was essentially the American model, which is, yes, you need to separate church and state and mosque and state to make sure that you have a level playing field between all different sorts of religions and make sure that the secular world and the religious world are separated in a formal way, but that doesn't mean that you can't have a vigorous religious life.
We've talked, of course, mostly about Christianity and Islam. There are a lot of other religions in the world, and there are a lot of very large sects in other places. We haven't even begun to talk about India, which does deal in both Christianity and Islam, but also there is Hinduism, there's Buddhism, and this is a huge part of the world. Are we seeing the same conflict between religiosity and modernism there?
One of the best pieces of research I think I did while writing this book was to go to a mega temple in Bangalore, which is, of course, the software capital of India. And I met the chief monk. He had a business card which said that he was the chief monk and CEO of the monastery. We had this huge boardroom with a big mahogany table and lots of leather-bound chairs all around it. We sat there, and he showed me a video on his flat-screen television. He gave me a PowerPoint presentation of what was going on in the monastery. This is a very, very—I don't know if you've ever been to a Hindu monastery, but the worship is, you know, obviously very, very traditional. It's been going on in the same way for hundreds and hundreds of years. You're transported back into a sort of what seems like an eternal world. And on the other hand, he was telling me that his monastery had been audited by Pete Marwick to make sure that it was very efficient, that on his board, he had a board of directors, which included many people from local software companies. They're conscious of running the monastery on the most up-to-date business themes. And one of the reasons he was doing this was that one of the fundamental commitments of his monastery was to feed the hungry. And this had always meant in the past that hungry people would come to the monastery and the monks would give them food. But he thought, should they just be coming to the monastery or we should be going to them? And so they set up a huge kitchen to make food to feed hungry schoolchildren. And so the monastery feeds now more than 100,000 schoolchildren in Bangalore. They have this huge kitchens with vast machines that create chapatis. They have hundreds of workers, and they prepare all this food. Then they put them into trucks. They have this huge modern fleet of trucks, which are actually covered with advertisements for various Philips electronic things. And these trucks all go out in the morning through the, you know, the traffic-clogged streets of Bangalore and distribute all this food. I ate some of the food. It was absolutely delicious to these schoolchildren. So they are applying modern techniques of advertising, of management, of mechanization, of organization to the preparation of food so that they can fulfill their ancient injunction to feed the hungry. It's a remarkable sight.
Adrian Wooldridge, he's the Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist magazine and co-author with John Micklethwaite of the book God Is Back.
Lord, I know you can.
Yes, Lord.
I know you will.
Yes, Lord.
You fight my battle.
Yes, Lord.
If I just keep still.
Yes, Lord.
Oh, the Lord never fails all around me.
The power of prayer is a phrase that's thrown around pretty loosely. But Lima Bowie used that power to overthrow a dictator, end a war, and bring peace to her native Liberia. Jenny Rediker tells Bowie's story in the documentary Pray the Devil Back to Hell. It's the extraordinary tale of Christian and Muslim women coming together in the midst of a seemingly endless and bloody civil war. These women unite and take on the violent warlords of both the lured rebels and the corrupt and brutal Charles Taylor regime. Armed only with white T-shirts and the power of prayer, the women of Liberia achieve the unimaginable, peace. Jenny Rediker talked with Anne Strainchamps about Praying the Devil Back to Hell.
Pray the Devil Back to Hell actually is a riff on something that Lima Bowie said during the interview. She was talking about Charles Taylor, and she said Charles Taylor could pray the devil out of hell. And when I thought about what the women did, by the Christian and Muslim women coming together, they really basically joined forces to pray the devil back to hell.
As though Charles Taylor had unleashed some kind of devil in Liberia.
I don't know if it was only Charles Taylor who unleashed it. I mean, Lord was pretty bad, too, and the whole situation had completely gotten out of control, and the country had really lost its moral compass.
Mm. Can you put all of this in some context? Remind us about Liberia under the reign of Charles Taylor and the lured rebels.
Well, Liberia, you know, is an incredibly resource-rich country. It has rubber, all the Firestone tires come from there. It's got timber. It's got all these natural resources. And basically, there was a war between forces who were trying to control the resources. So Charles Taylor was in power. He had come to power after many years of civil war. And after a couple of years, his brutal reign, people started fighting again. But it wasn't like the lured who was a resistance or fighting against him, that they were really fighting because they wanted to represent the will of the people and bring schools and water and that kind of stuff. They basically were all fighting to control natural resources and to control wealth. It was incredible brutality where kids were being forcefully conscripted and women were being raped in brutal ways. And Charles Taylor was very much a supporter of the rebels in Sierra Leone that were controlling the diamond industry and cutting off people's limbs. So it was an incredibly brutal war.
And both Taylor and the rebel warlords also were conscripting a lot of young boys as soldiers. These were the stories, really, that were the kind of turning point for the international community, that you'd get these young boys hopped up on drugs. They were handed guns and machetes, and they perpetrated terrible crimes.
Right, yeah, the kids as young as 9 years old were being forcibly conscripted and forced to do horrible things. And right, they were actually having some mixture of like cocaine and gunpowder injected into their brains to kind of hype them up for battle. And things were really horribly out of control.
Singing! We will go by, go by! Oh, land of liberty! Oh, one day we will. Sweet Liberia! Oh, the land of liberty! Oh, Liberia! Oh, one day.
So tell me about Liba Bowie and the Women in the Peace Building Network. How did they begin to organize and why?
Well, actually, the women's movement actually in Liberia began in the 90s, and they, you know, started out first like by trying to do letter writing campaigns and trying to figure out how they could bring the attention of the world to what was happening. And by, you know, the year 2003, things were completely out of control. And Lima, who had been a social worker and really started working with refugees, and she, one night she had a dream about bringing the women together to pray for peace, as she puts it. And the day that they went to announce to their church what the women were going to do and this initiative that they had, just happened that there was this other woman there, Satu Kenneth, who is a Muslim woman. She was in the police force, and she was doing some work for the police that day and was at the church, and she heard what the women were saying, and she said, oh, my God, this is great. I'm going to bring this on to the Muslim women.
So back when the Christian and Muslim women were first coming together, what did the women in the Peace Building Network actually do at first?
They had a lot of prejudice against each other. So the first thing that they did, actually, is they had this three-day workshop where they all came together. And first, the Muslim women got to say all the things that they didn't like about the Christian women or they didn't trust about the Christian women. And then the Christian women said all the things that they mistrusted or didn't like about the Muslim women. And then they came together and figured those things out. And after this workshop, they decided that they had to find things that they could work together on. So this was actually a while, you know, maybe in 2002. And so by the time that the war, it was really closing in on Monrovia, they were able to call the women to come together, and they sat on this field, which is this field that Charles Taylor had to drive past in order to go to work. And there was 2,500 of them on the field every day.
And they just sat there.
They sat there and they said, we want peace and we want you to talk to us and we want you to go to Ghana to these peace talks. And, you know, what they were doing was incredibly brave because Taylor had said that anybody who was in the street, you weren't allowed to assemble with more than five people and you would be killed. But because they had people from both sides, there was really not much Taylor could do. What was he going to do? Kill a bunch of women? And they all dressed like in white to represent that they were like taken from the Bible, where Esther dresses in sackcloth and ashes and saying that, you know, we want peace, we want peace.
This is an extraordinary story in so many ways. Why is Lima Bowie alive? I mean, the protests, as you said, were an affront and an embarrassment to Charles Taylor. He had had many people tortured and killed. Why not her?
Well, I mean, I don't think that Lima was alone. I mean, they were very strategic thinkers. I mean, it's kind of like comparing it to Martin Luther King. I mean, that basically she represented a mass movement of people who really wanted peace. I mean, Taylor's aunt was probably in the crowd with her. Taylor's mother probably stopped by some days. You know, that he couldn't really attack the women. I mean, you can't attack a bunch of unarmed women. It's too much. And they were very strategic about the way they did things. For instance, if men wanted to join them in the field, they wouldn't let the men because they knew that if there were men on the field, they would get attacked.
Eventually, amazingly, Charles Taylor actually met with the women. What happened at that meeting?
It was an amazing, astonishing meeting where the women actually confronted Taylor with what their demands were. They said, we demand that you go to the peace talk. We're tired of seeing our children killed, our children raped. We're hungry. We're tired of being hungry. And eventually, Taylor agrees to go to the peace talks, which is the first time that he agreed to go and talk about peace.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Network Africa from the BBC. Peace talks are due to begin today in Ghana between the warring factions in Liberia. There's been pressure on both sides to end a war which has destabilized much of West Africa. It'll be the first time the Liberian President Charles Taylor has talks with the rebel movements which are now trying to oust him.
When Taylor and the Lured rebels both agreed to go to the peace talks, that in itself was stunning. But then the peace talks stalled and the women kind of got back in action. What happened?
The women marched to the peace talks. They surrounded the peace talks and they said, we're not going to let you out, any of you, until you come up with a comprehensive peace plan. We're tired of you just sitting here and negotiating for more and more power. We want peace and we want it now, and we're not going to let you out of this room until you come out with a peace plan. So the police came to arrest them for obstructing justice. And Lima says when she heard the words obstructing justice, are you kidding me? And she said that she just went wild. And so the women said, okay, we're going to strip right here, right now, to shame you. We're going to strip in front of the world to say that you have brought us to this point. The press is here. The whole world will see that you've reduced the women of Liberia to standing naked in front of the world begging for peace. So the men definitely did not want the women to embarrass them that way, and they begged them not to do that. And the chief negotiator came and negotiated with the women, and the women gave their demands, and they said, okay, they would pull the women off, but that they insisted that they wanted a complete negotiated peace plan within 2 weeks. And 2 weeks later, there was a signed peace treaty.
By the time we enter our community, children will start singing, we want peace, no more war. We want peace, so no more war. And we just have this train of children following us all of the time. That was the moment for us.
And one of the most amazing things is that there had been many, many, many peace treaties in Liberia, I think 14 in as many years, and they were all broken. So one of the things that the women were also incredibly astute about is they knew that they couldn't just go home and say, okay, we have a peace treaty. They got that peace treaty. They saw what the benchmarks of it were, and they made sure that for the next 2 years, because it was a two-year transition process to elected democracy, and the women made absolutely sure that they stayed on that field, that they organized, and that they held the feet to the fire of all the people who were involved in that treaty to make sure that every benchmark was met and that, in fact, that there were free and fair elections in Liberia, which resulted in the first woman to be elected head of state in Africa, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So she's the first woman president in Africa.
I want to hear now, gratefully acknowledge the powerful voice of women from all walks of life whose votes brought us to victory.
That's Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Africa's first female head of state, speaking at her inauguration in 2006. The documentary Pray the Devil Back to Hell was directed by Jenny Redeker, who spoke with Anstrange Champs. Charles Taylor is currently on trial in The Hague for crimes against humanity.
She gave me life when I started. She stayed with me and never fought. She held me close when I cried, wept the tears from my eyes.
Does God have a history? Coming up, we'll hear Robert Wright's controversial argument for how monotheism evolved. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There's something to offend just about everyone in Robert Wright's new book, The Evolution of God. The book recounts in harrowing detail how the early Israelites invoked Yahweh to wreak vengeance on the Babylonians who'd conquered them. And Wright's no kinder to Christianity. His Jesus is not the prophet of peace and love. but an apocalyptic preacher obsessed with the approaching end times. Despite all this religious mayhem, Wright also thinks there's an underlying moral order, and he believes that humanity is marching, however wobbly, toward moral truth. So how can we come to grips with our ancestors' ideas about God? Wright told Steve Paulson that we need to understand the rough-and-tumble politics of the ancient Middle East.
At its birth, monotheism was fundamentally about retribution. Israel was a small nation in a bad neighborhood that had gotten kicked around, and this culminated in the exile, which was humiliating, and it dispossessed the Israelites. The temple was destroyed. It's not crazy to compare the mindset of the Israelites at this point to the mindset of the Palestinians, who feel humiliated and dispossessed. In the book, I argue that this kind of mindset brings out the belligerence in a religion. And I think it did at the birth of monotheism.
So you're drawing a link then between the political survival of a people or the political power of a people and the God they believed in. They somehow became one and the same.
Well, there was always in ancient times a close association of politics and gods. I mean, the victor of a war was always the nation whose god beat the other god. But what I think happened, the specific political dynamic that I think monotheism reflected at its birth, was Israel's desire and maybe plan to punish other nations by A, denying the very existence of their gods, and B, envisioning a day when their God Yahweh would make this point by actually subjugating the nations. This is very clear in 2nd Isaiah. It's not talked about much.
So Yahweh becomes a tool for Israelite kings to consolidate political power?
In the run-up to monotheism, I think you see that, especially with King Josiah, who I talk about at length in the book. You know, I think Israel was polytheistic for a lot longer than some people think it was. A lot of things factored into its movement toward monotheism, and one of them was, yes, a king who wanted to eliminate domestic political rivals, and those political rivals would have claimed access to various gods other than Yahweh. And so King Josiah wanted to eliminate them, and he killed some of them, but he also made it illegal to worship their gods. So I think that gets you up to monotheism. On the brink of monotheism, I think the exile pushes you over, and at that point you have a very kind of belligerent, I would say exclusive kind of monotheism, whose very point is to exclude other nations from this kind of privileged circle of God's most favored people. However, I do think after the exile, monotheism evolves into something much more laudable and inclusive. Now Israel, the exiles are returned to Jerusalem. Israel is now in a secure neighborhood because it's part of the Persian Empire, and so are its neighbors. And you see a much sunnier side of God coming out. You see expressions of tolerance and compassion even toward nations that previously were reviled in pre-exilic scriptures. And what that shows is that I think monotheism itself is not intrinsically good or bad. It depends on the circumstances in which it finds itself.
And then for today's religious believer who reads the Bible, I mean, this gets pretty confusing because we go back to some of these early books in the Old Testament, and that is a vengeful God, a God who says at times you need to wipe out people with different religious beliefs, and then other times there are very different pictures of God within the same sacred text. It's kind of confusing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, the contrasts are extreme. I mean, at one point in the Hebrew Bible, God is saying, I want you to annihilate nearby peoples who worship the wrong gods, and you know, lest there be any misunderstanding of what he has in mind, he says, do not leave anything alive that breathes. Not livestock, nothing. Women, children, everything goes. And then in other times, you have the Israelites not only tolerating a neighbor who worships another god, but in a sense, using that other god to validate their desire for tolerance. So they'll say to the Ammonites, you know, look, you've got your god, Chemosh. He gave you your land. We've got our god, Yahweh. He gave us our land. Can't we just get along? So there's this kind of vacillation in the Bible. There's this kind of vacillation in the Quran. I think in both cases, it's basically a question of whether people think they can gain through peaceful interaction with other people or not. And I think that's the challenge in the modern world.
Well, let's skip ahead to the next great monotheistic religion. Why did Christianity take root?
First of all, I think that the doctrines we associate with Christianity probably took root a little later than a lot of people think. I think there's reason to doubt that Jesus actually is the source of a lot of the stuff we consider most laudable in Christianity, universal trans-ethnic, transnational love, for example. I think that is a product of people like the Apostle Paul, who after the crucifixion carried the Jesus movement into the Roman Empire. And I think Paul wanted to build a network of churches. I think he was a true believer, but I also think that he went about this in a very pragmatic, business-like way. And I think in many ways, the church served as a networking service. And that was part of its appeal, certainly to elites, to like merchants. The network of Christian churches made it easier for them to travel from city to city in the Roman Empire and do business. The Roman Empire was, in a way, waiting for a church to dominate it. You know, I think beyond a certain point, when Christianity reached critical mass, then the dominance of the Roman Empire almost became inevitable.
So you're saying that later Christians, the Apostle Paul, among others, really institutionalized Christianity. But what about the historical Jesus? What do we know about him?
You know, it's popular in deciding which things that are attributed to Jesus were really said by Jesus. It's popular to say he said the good stuff and not the less good stuff. I think it's the opposite, pretty much.
He is usually seen as the great prophet of peace and love.
Yeah. But the fact is, like the Sermon on the Mount, which is a beautiful thing, does not appear in the first gospel that was written, Mark. And these views are not attributed to Jesus in the letters of Paul, which are the earliest post-crucifixion documents we have. You see Paul develop a doctrine of love and universal love, and you see that its practical value is to keep the church together, but he's not by and large attributing this stuff to Jesus. So too with love your enemies. Paul says something like love your enemies. He doesn't say Jesus said it. It's only in later gospels that this kind of stuff gets attributed to Jesus. And, you know, I should say this will seem dispiriting to some people to think that maybe Jesus wasn't the great guy we thought he was. To me, it is actually more inspiring to think that the doctrines of transnational, transethnic love were actually very likely products of a multinational kind of imperial platform. And the reason I find that inspiring is because one thing that does seem to have been in the cards in human history is that social organization grows, and it grows beyond ethnic bounds, and it comes to encompass diverse ethnicities and nations and so on. And if it is natural under those circumstances to develop doctrines that bring us closer to moral truth, like universal love, that to me is encouraging. And I think you see it in all three religions.
So if Jesus was not the figure of peace and love that he is generally thought to be, what kind of person was he?
I think he was your typical Jewish apocalyptic preacher. He was preaching that the kingdom of God was about to come. He didn't mean in heaven. He meant, you know, God's going to come down and straighten things out on this earth for good. You know, thy kingdom come in the Lord's Prayer means the kingdom comes down here. He wasn't talking about going up to heaven, I think.
But isn't the revolutionary aspect of Jesus' teachings that he made no distinctions among classes, social classes, that, I mean, essentially the poor were just as worthy as the rich? And wasn't that a radical idea for his time?
I think it's certainly quite plausible that his message was pitched toward the dispossessed. I think that part is true, but I don't think it extended beyond ethnic bounds. And I also don't think it was that original. I mean, in the Hebrew Bible, you see a number of prophets who are crying out for justice on behalf of the poor. So that wasn't a new thing that somebody would have a constituency that includes the dispossessed. I'm glad it was good. I'm sure he was in many ways a laudable person. I think more good things have been attributed to him than really bear weight.
I want to step back for a moment and talk about your overall approach to explaining the history of religion. You have obviously written a secular history. I sort of read this as a work of sociology, and you were looking at the way religion is used by various political movements and groups to gain and consolidate power. But you're pretty much ignoring the power of personal spiritual experience, what some people would call revelation. And I guess I'm wondering if you can really explain religion without acknowledging the importance of actual religious experience.
I, first of all, do think religious experience has played an important part in religion. I guess that's not that controversial a claim when you think about it. I think the Apostle Paul felt genuinely inspired. I myself have had profound experiences that maybe could be characterized as religious. Well, I certainly had some when I was young and was a believing Christian, but even since then, I mean, I did it like a one-week silent meditation retreat and had very profound experiences.
Can you tell me about that? What kinds of profound experiences did you have?
Well, first of all, as the week wore on, my consciousness, the kind of walls between me and the rest of, and other people and the rest of reality broke down a little, became much less negatively judgmental about things. You know, I remember at one point looking at a weed and thinking, I can't believe I've been killing weeds because, you know, they're as pretty as anything else. I mean, who put this label on weeds, you know? And that's just kind of a metaphor for what was changing in my consciousness. And it was completely profound by the end of the week. Now, of course, you know, a week later, I was a jerk again. It kind of wore off. But it was profound. And it was a movement toward, I think, moral truth. The truth is, you are not special. I am not special. You're not special. That, in a way, is the key adaptation that religions have to make in the modern world, is to increasingly make people better at appreciating the perspective of people in circumstances very different from their own and acknowledging the moral value of those people. And that is a movement toward moral truth. And it's an interesting thing to me that the system seems to be set up in such a way that as technology expands the realm of social organization, its ongoing coherence and integrity depends on moral progress in this sense. That's a fascinating feature of the world we live in.
Robert Wright talked with Steve Paulson. His book is called The Evolution of God. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to read more about Robert Wright's argument for an underlying moral order, go to our website at ttbook.org. You'll find a transcript of Steve's interview with Wright that ran in Salon magazine. At our website, you can also comment on what you've heard or visit us on our Facebook fan page. If you want to buy a CD of the show, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program God is Back, number 719A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Mary Lou Finnegan, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Ann Strainchamps. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.